Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We see on May 1st, pasture and rangelands in the United States rated 56%, very poor to poor. That is obviously a function of the punishing drought in place from the Great Plains westward.
That's USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
That 56% for this time of year is really staggering because the all-time record going back to the mid-90s is 59%, and that occurred in late summer of 2012. So we typically see declining rangeland and pasture conditions. As you move through the mid to late summer months, that's very normal. Pastures tend to brown out. And so to see a number like 56% this time of year is really sobering and indicates that we could be in big trouble in terms of production from those pastures and rangelands from the Great Plains westward as we move through the summer, unless things really turn around from a weather standpoint.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
One issue that's sort of important to me right now is, you know, is this sort of spectrum reform more generally, and we've seen sort of this challenge over the last couple of years of other agencies attempting to, you know, arrogate to itself power to regulate in the spectrum context that Congress didn't give it in.
Explaining intra-agency fighting, this is within the federal government, FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr.
We've seen it increasingly in the C-band with FAA and DOT. I mean, look, I came to the FCC in 2012 because I wanted to go work for the nation's, you know, spectrum regulator, and now as a commissioner, I really like, you know, participating in the establishment of the regulatory framework for wireless. And little did I know that I should have been applying to the Department of Transportation, that they're the nation's premier spectrum regulator, at least when it comes to C-band. But for my part, you know, I'm not just going to sit back while DOT tries to eat our lunch. And this isn't, like, new with DOT. It's not new with the Biden administration. We saw this during the Trump administration as well. We saw it with DOT back then. We saw it with NOAA with the 24 gigahertz band. We see it across the board. We see it with DOD, obviously, with Legato and other instances. And at the end of the day, Congress made a decision that said the FCC is the nation's spectrum regulator. You can feed your views into it, get your studies into it. The FCC is going to listen to all stakeholders, and we're going to make the decision that's in the public interest. And so I saw, you know, recently the DOD made some more comments about not knowing that everything is going to be completely copacetic by this next deadline we have for the C-band. And from my view, you know, that's unacceptable. If there's any changes that should be made with respect to the regulatory framework of the FCC licensees with respect to their build-out pursuant to the FCC's regime, it should be made by the FCC.
Which is why the public and private sectors can work together to fuel long-term economic growth. Dr. Cecilia Rouse is chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisors.
The president is a capitalist. I believe in markets, so this is not about being socialist. But what we know is that the private sector working on its own won't make the kinds of long-term investments in infrastructure, physical infrastructure, in people, in basic science that are so critical to long-term economic growth. So what we know is that we need to have the public sector and private sector working together so that the public sector makes investments, the private sector can really capitalize on some of those investments and bring it to scale. That the vaccine technology, the mRNA is a good example. Basic science was actually funded by NIH and federal funds, and then the private sector could really take it to benefit from that and take it to scale. And we have all benefited from those investments in a way that is very cost beneficial from the public perspective. So this president really understands that over the last three decades, as we've had policymaking that has really shunned the public sector's role in ensuring we have robust economic growth that is widely shared, that we are looking to make those kinds of investments that make our economy just work better, much more efficiently.
But we can't hide the fact that we're in turbulent times. Does the future still look bright?
It's going to be bumpy in the very short term, given that we are still working through a pandemic and we have Russia's war on Ukraine. But I am excited. We know that we've just made a historic investment in our physical infrastructure. We know that we have a president who's really focused on making the kinds of investments to help families, lower costs for childcare, to make investments in education, to lower costs for prescription drugs. And we had such rapid growth last year that we have some resilience to withstand some of the headwinds that will be thrown at us or that will come our way due to the war in Russia's war in Ukraine and the kinds of policymaking that the Federal Reserve Board will do in order to address inflation. So I am optimistic. I believe that the U.S. has so much potential and that we can be making the kinds of smart investments that we need in order to have sustainable growth that generates sustainable wage increases for workers, and that is more widely shared.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Yeah, you would think if we were talking SEC, it would be, you know, what the Big Ten schools worry about on Saturdays in the fall. But unfortunately, it's not football or sports related. It is the Securities and Exchange Commission.
That's Andrew Walmsley, Senior Director of Government Affairs, American Farm Bureau Federation, on why ag is worried about the SEC.
You know, yeah, they're focused on Wall Street, and unfortunately, they've kind of veered over to Main Street and impacting the potential businesses of both farmers and ranchers. They have a proposed rule around climate disclosure that goes much further than what you would traditionally think SEC would like information on. And those are those companies that are registrants, those large companies, you know, that are regulated by the SEC. This proposed rulemaking is looking at their emissions and their climate risk. And there's three different scopes when you talk about different greenhouse gas emissions. Scope one and two are things that companies traditionally can control. It's their emissions. A lot of them report this voluntarily. Scope two is kind of their energy usage. That's, once again, nothing too complicated. But what the SEC has proposed here and what's the real problem is scope three. And that reaches down into their value chain. And so you think for most farmers and ranchers, pretty much everything we produce outside of, you know, direct to consumer type sales is probably going to get in the hands of a pretty large company that's regulated by the SEC. And so this regulation is really going to put a lot of pressure pushed down from these companies onto farmers and ranchers.
Walmsley explains that under the proposed rule, farmers won't deal directly with the SEC.
There's probably a smaller segment of the shareholder community that's really calling for this information. But like with most things, you know, there's a bit of activism tied to it and really intense vocal minority that wants some of this information. And I think some companies are going to be very concerned on potential liabilities tied to this rule. And so what will that requirement, because of that concern, be pushed onto farmers and ranchers? That's where we have concern, is that these companies are going to ask for information from farmers and ranchers that A, we either don't have, or B, we don't know where to turn to. And a lot of these companies have teams of compliance officers or lawyers that keep them straight. We know that's not the case in agriculture. You know, and then there's other concerns, you know, is if we were to get this data in a way that then it put us out of business, you know, what then is out there to protect our privacy? We're a very unique industry where the majority, 98% of farms and ranches in this country are family owned. And then we tend to live there. We're one of the few businesses where you actually live and raise your children at your place of business. So what type of location privacies that are going to be protected in there? The rule doesn't really address those. And then finally, it's just liabilities, right? What happens when an audit takes place? What happens with one company reports one way and a different company reports another way? Who's going to ultimately be the referee? It's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of cost we see baked into this rule, and that's what causes us such concern.
But 39 days isn't long enough to really sort through it. That's why Farm Bureau joined with other groups asking for an extension.
We did put in an extension request. It had 120 groups on there. Our friends, National Pork Producers Council, National Cattlemen's, a lot of the ag commodity groups, some of our state farm bureaus got involved with that. So we have at least had a minor victory, I guess you could say it, after that extension request that the SEC did grant us some more time. But yeah, this is something that we're trying to educate folks on, not only our members, but also Capitol Hill, you know, getting Congress more involved. We need folks speaking up on our concerns on this proposed rule.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
My name is Coy Young. I'm a fourth-generation cattle farmer from the rolling hills of northern Missouri. I come here before you today and try to save what is left of rural America, because rural America is under attack by the greed and corruption of the big four that are in question here today.
Young, a Missouri cattle producer at a recent House Ag Committee hearing on an examination of price discrepancies, transparency, and alleged unfair practices in cattle markets.
For years, the packing industry has been concentrating more and more with fewer, larger mega plants to process our proteins. The American cattle farmers and ranchers are tired of being taken advantage of and losing money year after year while watching the big four post record profits every single quarter. The packers have manipulated the system with their alternative marketing agreements or arrangements, which was formerly known as captive supply, with the huge corporate-owned feed yards that control 87% of the fed beef in this country. AMAs have killed the cash market and competition within the beef industry, making the markets the cow-calf producers have to compete in so depressed for the times. Bankruptcy rates continue to be on the rise, and we're at a 10-year high in 2019. The Packers and Stockyards Act of 1921 was put in place to protect the cattle farmers and ranchers from the very thing that's happening within the beef industry today. I ask, why are we not enforcing the Packers and Stockyards Act? Is everyone watching on the payroll of the Big Four to let them continue their free reign without consequence? AMAs are legalized market manipulation practices that should not be allowed and enforced under the Packers and Stockyards Act of 1921. There's an alarming number. The number is 40.27 cattle farms that call it quits every single day in this country for the past three decades because they can no longer make ends meet. Alone, that should grab the attention of leaders in Washington that there is a problem going on here. Family legacies and century farms are being ripped out of their hands, and families are losing their loved ones from an unprecedented amount of suicides. Farming and ranching has the most suicides in any industry due to stress, a shrinking bottom line, and that's fueled by the greed and capitalistic nature that's everyday business in the Big Four that are in question here today. There's blood on the hands of the Packers and leaders in Washington, and no one seems to care. No one seems to want to do anything about it. I know we live in a country where capitalism reigns supreme, and it's every man for himself, but Packers take capitalism to a whole new level. We as cattle farmers and ranchers just want an even playing field and be able to raise our families and live a decent life our fathers and grandfathers did before us. Nowadays in rural America, everyone in the farming community has one, two, or even three extra jobs outside of the farm to help pay their bills and make ends meet. The cows no longer pay for themselves and haven't for a very long time now. I never thought I would see the day when feeding America will become a part-time job. It's wrong and it's not fair. There's enough money to go around in the beef industry. It's the distribution of profits that are proportionally unbalanced that is the problem. I know I sound like a broken record, but it's from the manipulation of the Big Four packers that control 85% of the beef packing industry, but they also control 87% of all the fed cattle that are slaughtered.
Young concluded his testimony.
The market share that was once the cattle farmers has since been redistributed to the middlemen, the packers, and the grocers. Make all the money, and we pay all the inputs, and go broke raising the very product they profit so handsomely from. I mean, what's America going to do when there aren't any American family farms left to produce the most flavorful, juicy steak in the world?
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
There's no doubt that the bills we are discussing this morning are the result of the frustration at the prices America's farmers and ranchers receive for their cattle in relation to the prices consumers ultimately pay for their beef products.
The issues of price discrepancies, transparency, and alleged unfair practices in cattle markets leading both the House and the Senate to hold hearings recently. On the Senate side, the ranking member from Arkansas, John Bozeman.
There's a significant difference in these two prices, and I understand and I share the frustration of cattle producers. I also understand the desire of some of my colleagues to propose legislative solutions to address this frustration, and I appreciate all of their hard work bringing this to the forefront. Before Congress passes any changes to the law, I believe we have a responsibility to understand the issue we are seeking to solve and to understand the proposed solution. Since the sponsors introduced their first version of the legislation in November 2021, we've spent many hours reviewing the proposals, talking with USDA officials, and soliciting input from the nation's prominent cattle and beef industry and economists. My charge to my staff was to learn all they could about the legislation and talk to the experts, including cow-calf producers, backgrounders, feeders, and packers. We supplemented these efforts with academic analysis. This morning's hearing is one more step we are taking to learn about the issues and the cost and benefits of the proposed legislation. Over the last few months, as I and my staff have studied S-4030 and its predecessor, we have learned a few things about the potential impact of the legislation. I share this with my colleagues to help inform the discussion, hopefully allow us to seek comments and clarifications from our witnesses. If adopted, the impacts of S-430 would include the number of cattle marketed under AMAs will decrease and the number of cattle sold in the cash market will increase. For example, in Texas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico, between 340,000 and 2.5 million fed cattle will need to move out of formula contracts annually. In Iowa and Minnesota, it's fewer than 2,000 head a year. Using Texas A&M's analysis and economic cost estimates from Dr. Kuntz, the cost of the shift away from the AMAs will cost cattle producers between $23 million and $249 million annually, depending on how the Secretary of Agriculture decides to implement the law over the 5 years analyzed by Texas A&M. The costs are in the hundreds of millions of dollars. The cost to cattle producers are not all borne equally. Some regions will be more heavily impacted than others. Nearly 90% of the economic cost of this bill are estimated to be borne by farmers in Kansas, Southern Plains, including Texas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico. The conversations I've had with participants in all sectors of the cattle industry have raised some questions that I believe we need to consider. How do the proposed solutions influence packer concentration? What region or sectors of the cattle industry will ultimately benefit, and what regions or sectors will bear the cost? Does S-4030 disincentivize investment and innovation? With the utilization of AMAs capped, what tools do producers have to manage risk? What will the cattle industry look like in a decade if this legislation is enacted? And how would these bills have changed the supply and demand dynamics during the COVID-19 pandemic or other black swan events?
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
There's a number of things we could talk about on this. I think the first thing you've got to consider, you know, is what's going to happen with inflation.
Kevin Brinkley is CEO of Lubbock-based Plains Cotton Cooperative Association.
Again, not just a U.S. story, but a global one. In fact, here in the U.S., it doesn't feel like it for those of us that live here, but we might actually be in better shape than a lot of other developed economies around the world, and certainly much better shape than the underdeveloped economies. But, you know, you see year-over-year inflation prints, and we've been running several months of these now of 6 and 8% over the previous year. Sooner or later, a consumer is going to have to make hard choices. And, you know, we know that from experience that most of that time they protect their vital organs, you know, which is food and gasoline and those sorts of things. And so we'll kind of have to wait and see what kind of an impact that has on cotton. But you also have this, I've gotten where I hate to even utter this phrase, but supply chain constraints are still causing a whole lot of friction out there, and certainly it costs more to get goods from where they originated to where they're going, where the consumer wants it, and all that has left the Federal Reserve has had a very accommodated monetary policy, some would say loose, and they were trying to do that to generate some inflation, and they overshot the runway, and that's how we got these numbers that we're looking at today. So now they're trying to reverse engineer that and raise interest rates to suppress consumer demand to put downward pressure on prices. And you've seen some of that manifest itself in the stock market. You know, we sold off quite a bit there. And actually, if you look at the GDP for the U.S. in the first quarter, it was a contraction, a slowing of 1.4%, which was not expected. So we'll see where that heads. You know, if you're a producer, you're kind of feeling it in terms of input prices. Almost all input prices are heading toward, you know, if not record levels, very, very high. And that's mostly on the back of energy prices. Then you've got that little thing of war over that Russia has gone into Ukraine. That's just causing turmoil, and you're going to see that in terms of food prices, obviously, but it's also causing shipping issues around that part of the world. And then probably the worst one of all, Tony, I think, is the zero COVID policy in China. And I think you could probably take all these other factors and put those on one side of the ledger and put the zero COVID impact in China on the other side, and they might just about balance out if not tilt toward the Chinese problem. And, you know, you have places like Shanghai and Beijing, those two cities together are about 45 million people, and those are just two places. You've got lockdowns all over China where they make a great deal of the stuff that we consume here. They also use one out of every three bales of cotton grown in the world. And so if, you know, if those factories are slowed down because people can't go to work, that's certainly going to put a dent in the production of textiles, but also their ability to buy textiles. So if you're locked in your apartment in Shanghai, you cannot go out to the store and buy something. That's going to put a dent in demand there. So I hate to be the bearer of so much bad news, Tony, but this is just kind of the world that we live in at the moment. And, you know, we just got to figure out ways to make the best of it.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
My name is Jill Stockton. I raise sheep and cattle near Grass Range, Montana.
Again, Stockton, a Montana livestock producer, testifying recently at a House Ag Committee hearing on the examination of price discrepancies, transparency, and alleged unfair practices in cattle markets.
I took over the family ranch in 1975. The same year that I graduated from Montana State University with a master's degree in animal science. My wife and I started ranching with nothing except our degrees, the generosity of my parents, and a loan from the FHA. But if I had to start from scratch today, it would be impossible. We are losing an entire generation of motivated, talented, and trained young and women because they cannot afford to take over the family farm or ranch. As Mr. Young has just testified, the economic realities just do not allow it. In 1975, the concentration in the beef packing industry had four firms controlling 25% of the market. Today, they monopolize 85%. I lived and ranched through the entire period that has seen the beef industry become subservient to a monopoly cartel. In 1975, the year I started ranching, the farm-to-retail spread for beef stood at 71.3%. We ranchers and feeders were able to retain 71.3 cents of every dollar spent by the consumer at the grocery store. In 2021, the farm-to-retail spread was 36.5%. Over the course of my career in ranching, my income has been cut in half. In terms that are very concrete, and just like Mr. Young had said, in 1979, I purchased a one-ton four-wheel drive truck from the proceeds of selling 18 calves. The equivalent truck today would cost me 59 calves. Now, I don't want to give you the impression that I'm looking for sympathy. I've made my life, and it was a good life. But my concern is for my community, the future of agriculture, and the future of food security for this nation. My community has, over the course of my life as a rancher, dried up and blown away like a tumbleweed. Today, Grass Range, which was once a thriving small town, has only one functioning business on Main Street, a tire repair shop. And there is no part of U.S. agriculture that is not oppressed by monopolized, dysfunctional markets. And this long-standing market dysfunction was laid bare by the COVID-19 pandemic, when illness in the packing plant slowed the processing of cattle, resulting in empty shelves at the meat counter. And the packing cartel profited by buying cattle for less and selling beef for more. And I'm sure that we're going to hear here today how this is all about supply and demand. But it is also about having an entire meat production system funneled through a very narrow bottleneck where packers can exploit both producers and consumers, unless you, Congress acts, the American people will find themselves with an unreliable, extremely expensive food supply.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
This September, I'll be convening a White House conference on hunger, nutrition, and health.
President Joe Biden with the announcement on Wednesday. The conference is designed to catalyze both the public and private sectors.
Anti-hunger and nutrition advocates, food companies, local and state governments, tribal and territory communities to lay out our plan to combat hunger and improve nutrition for every American.
A whole-of-government approach designed to accelerate progress in areas ranging from improved nutrition to closing disparity gaps by the year 2030. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, in a statement Wednesday, acknowledges USDA's partnering in efforts to end hunger and increase healthy eating in America by 2030. Information about and ways to solicit ideas for the conference is available online.
Go to whitehouse.gov/hungerhealthconference.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.